No one plans for hair loss, but through Hims, you can take the next step with confidence. Access treatments made with clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil to stop hair loss and regrow hair in 3 to 6 months. No waiting rooms, no hoops, just ingredients with a track record of results. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you, with 100% online access to personalized treatments that put your goals first. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your free online visit. hims.com/Hail Mary. Individual results may vary, based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're back for part two of the discussion of the offense against the New York Jets. And joining me again is Spencer Peterson. Spencer, how you doing?
Doing well, Ken.
Still pretty much the same as you were an hour ago, I guess. But we had a great discussion, I thought, in the first part. Really enjoyed talking about some of the things that are holding back Derrick Henry this year. I thought that was one of the big topics. And it's I don't believe it's any one thing. You had a great idea about how you would look at tackles differently.
Yeah, you could potentially pick apart what is the opportunity set. So a big part, you know, it's not one single thing that's making his numbers worse this year, but at least one significant component of it is he's breaking fewer tackles. And my question was, is that on a individual opportunity, you know, player cohort standpoint, is he doing any worse, or is he just seeing a much greater share of the tackle attempts coming, you know, closer to the line of scrimmage or behind the line even, where typically tacklers have much higher success rates to begin with?
And I think, you know, there's multiple dimensions that make a very interesting study. If there is someone out there who wants to like look at that and then come on and do a film study short on it, would love to kind of look over your shoulder or help you over your shoulder in terms of how you would go about studying that in what I would consider to be a pretty good way. But if anyone is interested in that project, I think it'd be very entertaining to talk about that as a show in the future. We talked about some of the reasons to blame what was a fairly subpar, a fairly unremarkable performance from Lamar Jackson. It was not, in this case, in my opinion, really a case of the offensive line. We're getting into some of the offensive line scoring in a minute or two. But it was really more a case of he got a pretty decent opportunity set. He was betrayed by his receivers a few times. He did collect some DPI penalties, a couple of big ones. Big drop by Flowers. But otherwise, it wasn't one of Lamar's best games, is I think what we have to come back to.
No, absolutely. I don't think this is one that's going to be on the highlight reel for Lamar. I think you have so many countless other ones you could pick from that it's not even that this game was so terrible. It's just that typically we expect, you know, Lamar to be great. And this was a very decidedly, you know, and you were just talking about the opportunity set and his success against that, you know, almost the most mediocre game you could possibly have from that regard.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. And we talked a little bit about the gamblers and how they differ in opinion of the Ravens from DVOA metrics. The Ravens are about 77.3%. If you believe the gamblers to win the AFC North, DVOA has them at about 68.2%. That's actually a pretty substantial difference. And that has to go to someone. So DVOA is saying that the Steelers and the Bengals and the Browns are all sharing a portion of that nine percentage point difference there, which is a little interesting. So Spencer and I kind of cogitated over why that might be. We think the gamblers, I think between the two of us, we believe the gamblers probably have it right in terms of looking more at correctly discounting earlier in the season what might have happened.
Yeah, I think it's discounting, particularly on the defense. You pointed out that there is a method in there for, you know, correcting for, so to speak, the Lamarless games. Yeah. On the offensive side, but there's almost no way they're the worst defense of all time, even if you don't think they're as good as they were coming into the year. So although I'm generally pretty hesitant to, you know, make all these excuses and say, well, you don't really count this for that reason, I think directionally there's, you know, logic in coming a little closer in on those early games from that perspective. And then you raised the good point of there might also be some giving credit for the Ravens being a team that historically finishes very strong and improves as the season goes on and picks up steam. And, you know, that's probably a portion of that percentage point difference.
Yeah, they've done a wonderful job of fixing the team on the fly. We've talked about that in an episode recently of One Last Thing, so I don't want to go into that too much further, but I would like people to go listen to that if you care to.
And the last thing I'll say very quickly, I think you've seen that in DVOA actually the last couple of years where they finished so strongly in 23 and 24. They were not in that, you know, rarefied air of top 10 teams by DVOA at the midpoint of those seasons. It was the strong finishes of those years that really vaulted them up. They were quite good, but I believe they climbed spots in the end weeks of both of those years. So
climbed spots relative to the greatest teams of all time, because they were like the seventh and eighth, I think, or something like that of all time in DVOA the last 2 years. But
Yes. I mean that in those individual seasons, if you took the snapshot at the midpoint, they would not necessarily have always been in that top 10.
Fair
enough. As the season progressed, they climbed the ranking for that year, where they stacked up relative to other teams. So even from a DVOA standpoint, it's not just, hey, they won a bunch of games down the stretch. Their DVOA metrics improved down the stretch in those seasons as well.
And they certainly in the last 2 years, they have destroyed good teams. They went 19-7 against teams with winning records, and DVOA really rewards them for that to a good degree, because the quality of your opponent is a significant component of what underlies each game score for them. So,
absolutely. Well, we were just talking about the opportunity set afforded to Lamar and whether or not the offensive line, you know, is to blame or how they shape into the overall offensive performance. Do you want to get into your grading?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let me get my papers together here.
Great. And maybe I would assume it makes sense to go the traditional route, go left to right here with the line. Stanley coming off what was a very tough assignment with Myles Garrett, always is. And as the Browns showed with Oakland, they're a tough draw for anyone. How did Stanley acquit himself this week?
Yeah, he looked a lot better. Now he was primarily playing against it's number nine, and I had it in the article, and I've forgotten exactly who that is in the game. But he had him most of the game, and played well. Allowed one half a pressure. Lamar ran him out of one other pressure. It was a shared job with Rosengarten. He had missed four blocks in the game. I thought his mobility is one of the things that really struck me from this game. The scoring was excellent, by the way, and I'll get into that in a moment. But the one play that really stood out, which was one of two highlights he had, was on the 11-yard run by Flowers, which was on the very first drive. He ran all the way from the left tackle position all the way outside the numbers by the right sideline to block Brandon Stevens. And it wasn't a like four show, you know, movement, and then I'm going to make a block because I've gone this far kind of thing. It was an actual impactful block on the play by the time he got there. And Stanley is one of the few, I mean, even with the leg injuries he's had over his career, one of the few really high effort linemen who will make that kind of movement. I think it's Will McDonald actually is the guy I'm thinking of. Yeah,
I think so.
Oh, we want to talk scoring, or if you have anything to respond to on that, I can move forward.
One quick question on Stanley this week. When you look at this versus some of the games where he's had very poor scores, you mentioned the mobility. Is there anything else that's different that, you know, seems to be contributing to that positive result versus the times he's had those much poorer performances? Is it, you know, is he not getting, you know, beat back with the bull rush? Is he, you know, getting to his spots better? Like, is there anything distinct that you can point to that, you know, just looks different in a game where he's doing well?
This was a game, and there may have been a point of emphasis for him to like fight outside of the cone, make a distinct effort to not die slowly into the cone. And that's been a Stanley trick for his whole career with Lamar, is basically slow deaths causing, you know, some bump pressure, as I'll call it. And Lamar reacts extremely well to that under normal circumstances. Lamar right now, I think, is more considered about everything that's going on around his feet to a greater degree. And so Stanley in his normal position where his feet are, you know, one in front of Lamar's left foot and the other behind Lamar's left foot is not a good place for him to be. And he's had some pressures this year, certainly that have fallen into that category. I felt like this game, he did a better job of keeping that traffic away from the cone. And that was part of the reason why he scored well. And there are a couple that were still kind of close, but they, you know, I looked at them from all the angles that I had available, the all 22 and the replays that were on TV and whatnot, which are often very good, by the way. The camera behind the play is often the best look you'll ever get at a passing play, better even than the coach's film. But you know, he was good. He gave up half a pressure. He scored 50 out of a possible 56 points, which is 0.89 per play. That would be an A unto itself. Then he's entitled to a small adjustment on top of that. I didn't give him a big one, and part of it was Will McDonald is good, but he's not great. The other part of it is that he gave up a pressure that Lamar ran him out of, so I gave him a small deduction going the other way on that. So he gets a 0.93, right in the middle of the A range at left tackle. It's by far his best game of the year. His next best was the opener at Buffalo when he was 6 points less. If he's a 0.87, and then you go the next best after that was a C plus, 14 points lower. That was in, don't have the game here in front of me, but it's in the article if you want to know. So the C plus that was 14 points lower is his third best game of the year. So has not had a good year. This is a standout top shelf game. And you know, the portent it brings, I'm just very positive about.
Yeah, absolutely. If we can start getting more consistency across the offensive line, not even guys playing at, you know, the top end of the A range, but consistent Bs across the line would go do wonders for this team down the stretch.
Well, if my grading is a lot like PFF in the sense that if you had a B every game, you'd be an A easily for the season. So think of it as the old PFF, when you got to see the scores that underlied the number that they give you now on a 1-to-100 basis, you'd see like a, you know, a plus one or something for a guy who had a pretty good game. But if you accumulate a plus one for 17 straight games and your number is plus 17, you're going to be up at the top of the league in terms of your position group. So getting a B every game would be fantastic is my point.
Absolutely. Great. So going down the line, how about Voorhees?
So let's talk about Voorhees. He had a very bad play on the Ravens' third drive, gave up a sack that ended the drive. He's bulled, then beaten the outside by Briggs, who was stunting on the play. I believe he's stunting. I'm trying to think about if that's true. But anyway, he was bulled, then beaten outside by Briggs for that sack. Not a big name, but that was his biggest negative play. Also to give up half a pressure that he shared with Linderbaum on an unmatched depth situation where there was supposed to be a handoff. I don't really know who to blame. Linderbaum certainly got backed up further on the play. He probably deserves more of the blame. The phantom point is probably being charged to Voorhees, but Voorhees also wasn't in a position where he could have taken an additional step back and accepted that handoff. He gets a half of that pressure and he missed five blocks. He had a great streak of pulls coming into this game where he'd made 19 in a row and he made two more to extend the streak to 21. And then on the last drive, Kolar got backed up into the lane of his pull and ended his pull streak. So he gets a zero on that play, but had otherwise had a great streak of pulls, went 3 for 4 in this game. And it's 7 level 2 blocks. So he was one of the guys. This is a game where Linderbaum didn't climb at all, and both the guards climbed a lot. And that obviously is a case where the defensive alignment is playing a big role in that in terms of how they get their duo blocks going, their combination blocks going. And Linderbaum was the player who was getting set up to accept the back end of those blocks. But he did allow for a lot of that, you know, some pretty decent blocking from Voorhees and some decent play from Fa'alele as well in terms of climbing, though Fa'alele missed a lot of level 2 blocks in this game.
Yeah, I think one thing we probably didn't emphasize enough in the first half of the show was giving a little bit of credit to the Jets defense here. Yep. They, I thought, played quite a good game. Obviously, the Ravens ultimately, you know, the talent won out. But from a scheme perspective, from the way they were playing it, the Ravens did a few things to, you know, tie a hand behind their back to some degree. But the way the Jets were lining up and shifting the line around and the guys they had in the box, they were making it very difficult as I was rewatching this on the line, who, again, had a decent day, but it seemed like they were just always getting in position where the blocks the Ravens line was trying to make were just not well positioned. And I honestly would have liked to see a little bit more pulling, you know, maybe run some counter or some other things to get kind of more favorable strikes on the defenders. But got to give the Jets some credit there for, I think, you know, how they were able to scheme that up and line up and play there.
Yeah, they did. The Ravens did not get their linemen on the move the amount they normally did. They didn't run a single counter. In fact, it's been a couple of weeks since they've run one. I'm not sure. They might have run a couple at Minnesota, even with the crowded line of scrimmage. I have to go back and look exactly when they last ran a two-man pull from either left to right or right to left. They did have two that were really good Mitchell runs. That may be all the way back in the Bears game at this point. You know, that's now we're talking the beginning of the win streak. So, you know, 5 games ago, but I have to look and see if there was any instance there. But I think you're absolutely right. They didn't really move their guys very much to try and get better blocks. And what they did was largely by climbing. Voorhees overall for the game wasn't terrible. Got a 0.79 aggregate score, which is right in the middle of the C range at guard. You know, a solid game. This is the kind of game where you're really happy about it. And you could talk about accumulating B's and how you might have an A at the end of the time. Players like Voorhees just need to consolidate, you know, gains at a C level. And he's had plenty of really bad games. He's also had a couple games that have been above the waterline. This is one is right at the waterline. This is one he's not going to lose his job. It helps him, you know, firm up what he's got. I think he's giving the Ravens some mobility they don't otherwise have access to. And I don't think it's obvious that he's going to be the guy's replaced, because I think that the Emory Jones, who I'm sure we'll talk about later, is a more natural fit at right guard than at left guard. Not necessarily saying that Voorhees is out playing Fa'alele, but that might be the natural space for him to fit.
Yeah, absolutely. Go to the middle of the line. Do you want to touch on Linderbaum?
Yeah, we have to. He didn't have a good game this week, and I know PFF scored him well. I can talk to about some of the reasons why there's a big scoring difference here, because I have him at a D, so let's start with that. He made 51 out of 56 blocks, only had two missed blocks, which was the lowest on the line. That's good. He did allow a penetration. It was on a zone play to the left, but he had the man on his right shoulder and allowed him to come across actually behind him, but couldn't maintain him on his right shoulder there. And that ended up being a run for loss there. Then he allowed 1.5 pressures. One of those was shared with Voorhees. There's time references that are in the article if you want to go and refer to that. And then the big play, he had an offensive holding call that negated the 35-yard run by Mitchell. Now, there's no reason why he gets a worse negative score because Mitchell ran for 35 yards on the play, but he had a 10-yard penalty where the defense had an option to decline it as well. It turned out the option to decline was not particularly valuable in this case since Mitchell ran for 35 yards, but that option often is. Scored 41 points on the day, even with an adjustment, and he did very little in terms of mobility in this game. No level two blocks. He did have two pancakes, did not pull, and did not have any highlight blocks. So this wasn't a game where Linderbaum was out making plays all over space like we're used to seeing. It's a very unusual set of numbers down there. And it may even be something the Jets really thought about trying to do to him, was say, hey, we need our nose tackle to pin him down, to not let him get out into the level two and make it easy for Derrick Henry with these secondary blocks.
Yeah, that very well might have been. You know, I think if people wanted to be unfair to him in the way they have been to other, you know, linemen on this team, and I won't say any names because it's a lightning rod, but, you know, that play where he got completely swam by the defensive tackle for the Derrick Henry -1 yard run. Like, if you wanted to have a clip of someone to say, what is this guy doing? That's, you know, that's a play you could look at. It's just not a great day at the office for Linderbaum today.
Yeah. And you know, I hope we won't go in either direction on that. Right. You want to be continually surprised by the data. That's the whole fun of doing this kind of work. And if you don't, then you're probably just in the wrong position to be scoring offensive line play, because you're not scoring offensive line play. You're narrative building. That's what you're doing. So anyway.
So on the topic of narrative building, maybe moving down the right-hand side of the line, Daniel Fa'alele.
Yeah, not a terrible game for Fa'alele this game. And I know that'll disappoint some people, particularly those who thought Emory Jones was that close to stepping in for him. And he still might be, by the way. But 56 plays, 46 blocks. He missed 9 blocks in this game. It's still no shortage of places where you find Fa'alele being indecisive in level two and slow and ponderous moving around at a level two. Interestingly, he made 3 of his 4 pulls in this game, but he went to level two and made 6 blocks in this game, but he missed 6 others. So 6 for 12 that's not what you want in any blocking situation. You don't want to make half your blocks. And you know, obviously that's the Jets forcing guards to elevate and Linderbaum to not is a productive strategy if you think about it, if they can make that happen. So they did a good job, honestly. I think in this game, that's one of the things the Jets did well, particularly with the Harrison Phillips and what he did in this game. So anyway, Falele missed 9 blocks. Only allowed 1 half of pressure. That was his only negative event other than the false start at the end of the game, which is a 2-point deduction. It's not a real serious penalty. By the way, the reason why a false start is only a 2-point deduction, it used to be 3. I changed the system last year, I believe, to be -2 per 5 yards plus an extra -1 if the penalty is declinable. Okay. And that's, I believe I changed that last year. If it's not, it was this year. And I'm sure people who are real aficionados, and there are people who have backed into the formula before without me like explaining it for a couple of years. I've always been impressed by that. The -2 is a -5 yards at the only penalty. There's no ability to decline. So for example, the illegal downfield penalty is much more serious by an offensive lineman because it can negate a play and it can also be declined if the play's on third down and it doesn't get you the first. So anyway, Falele, 0.77 for the game, 0.04 adjustment gets him to a 0.81, which is still a C, and not a whole lot to say. Had a great highlight block, by the way, on the 2-yard touchdown run by Derrick Henry, where he was involved in 2 blocks on that play. So that was a really nice play for Daniel Falele. Probably one of his really nice plays of the season, if you think about it.
And that was the second touchdown run?
Yep.
Yeah, that one, and I forget if I mentioned it before the show or in the first half, but was a play where it was great to see. They just completely obliterated that side of the Jets' defensive line. But then there's a nagging part of you that says, where's this been this whole time? Because those short yardage, goal-to-go, compacted line situations have been seemingly just the thing that has hamstrung us in the red zone. And seeing them just make so much daylight for Derrick Henry to just kind of traipse through into the end zone was, again, great to see, but a little maddening to say, where has this been?
Yeah, I kind of feel like the hurricane play or the Lamar pitch play off Andrews under center are plays where you could kind of say the same thing. And the reason people say, where's this been the whole year, is because it worked. And in this situation, it happened to work. The Jets didn't flow to that gap, which was being exploited, and the Ravens, it could have driven a truck through it. But in this case, we're happy, and we ask, where was it? All right, I'll just move over to the right side and talk a little bit about Roger Rosengarten. He had a mixed game against Will McDonald, and Spencer, we talked a little bit about the first show about how Will McDonald is kind of mouthing off after this game a little bit. Not Will McDonald. Who is it? It's Jermaine Johnson.
Sorry. Jermaine Johnson. Yeah, and I think you made a great point that on the 2 tight end screens that just got completely obliterated, Jermaine Johnson was the one who sniffed that out and was basically holding Will Likely's hand, giving Lamar nowhere to go with that. And that's really where he should be thumping his chest. I think there's one play where he got blown up and he's basically saying he did the right thing because he got down and plugged up the gap while he's getting completely washed by Rosengarten. But he's been quite loud on social media about how this was actually a good game on his part.
Yeah, and it may have been overall. I think it was a pretty good game for Rosengarten too. So maybe a case where each of them has a case to make. I only scored 1 pressure against Rosengarten in this game. There were a number of times where Jermaine Johnson beat him to the outside, and Jermaine Johnson seems to be a guy who likes to win to the outside at the expense of some distance down pocket with the hope that he can come back and make a play from the backside. And by the way, those plays have a lot of value. You get a lot of quarterback strips when you come back and you're fast enough to get back. So it's not necessarily a bad strategy, but the counter strategy is, if you're bigger than your opponent, is to block him 12-6. If you heard me use that term before, and take the guy south of the pocket, you just got to make sure you hold on to your block. Last week, Stanley had such a block where he got, I think it was Garrett. He got by the pocket all the way around to about 4 o'clock before Garrett got free. And Stanley gave up on the block, frankly, and Garrett came back and got the sack. So it was a case of Lamar holding the ball too long. But in this game, only 1 pressure given up by Rosengarten, 1 false start as well. 79 was the raw score. He gets a small adjustment from that. Oh, he did allow 2 pressures. Lamar ran him out of 2 pressures. So he got a significant write down in his adjustment because of that. And he still crawls in at the bottom end of the B grade. So still a good game for Rosengarten. If he did that every week, you'd be thrilled about it. But a solid game.
Yeah, and I think you've made this point mostly about Voorhees, but seeing, you know, Rosengarten continue to stack positive performances in, I believe it's his second year.
Yep.
That, you know, portends well for the future of this offensive line, where you might have to shuffle some pieces in the offseason, but, you know, you hope or pencil in a little bit of, you know, positive development from a Voorhees and a Rosengarten, and hope that Stanley holds serve to some degree. And you're feeling a lot better about that offensive line if you're subbing out one or two pieces.
Yeah. I mean, if they had to replace Stanley, it would be one of the five alarm fire this offseason in terms of doing that, because Carson Vinson is the next man up, and we don't know where he is, other than we're excited that he was active for 2 weeks in there and then he was inactive again this week. But he's important. So Stanley playing well in 2026 is very important. If he's not ready to play in 2027, I think we'd feel a lot better about the exchange being made. And the contract was really set for that to occur, for him to be cut prior to the 27 season. Ravens save $16 million in cap, and they give the job over to Vinson or somebody else at that point. We need Rosengarten to continue playing well. Linderbaum might not be here next year. So it would be good if one of two things happened. Either Linderbaum plays well and the Ravens re-sign him, or if Bullock gets a chance and we at least can determine what we have before draft time. So, you know, do you need to spend a second round pick at center, or can you afford to give Bullock the job and maybe you spend a fourth or fifth round pick at center as a backup player? And then at left guard, I mean, you really got to hope that one of your two guards can stay. And the only one that it really makes sense for is Voorhees, who's still 2 years under cheap team control, gives you a little bit of mobility. So if he could show a little bit of value this year with two more years of runway, I think that'd be ideal for the Ravens. Are you the same place pretty much? Are you expecting Falele to be gone?
Yeah, I don't think there's almost any world in which it makes sense for him to come back. And I think I'd be in the Voss school of cap management on this one, that, you know, if he plays so poorly that no team is willing to offer him something above the minimum, I don't really want him back. If he plays better than that, which I expect him to, you know, play at least some decent above the replacement level, he's going to get an offer that I just don't think makes sense with our salary cap situation.
Yeah, completely agree. And this is kind of where I was when Michael Orr was in his last season with the Ravens. I didn't think there was a responsible contract we could construct that would make any sense relative to the market. And then he went off and he got overpaid on a couple more contracts after that. Good for him.
Yeah. I think you and I are aligned that some people are going to be, and this isn't me saying he's a great player by any stretch of the imagination, but a lot of people are going to be shocked by the offer he gets somewhere else.
Yep. I would agree with that. I don't think it's playing into the Ravens' consideration of whether they keep him in there. I know there's people that disagree with me on this, but the Ravens have so many people about to hit free agency. I don't think they really care about whether or not Daniel Falele gets them a fifth or a sixth round pick. I really don't think they care about that. And that probably is about the sort of difference they're talking about.
Yeah. And I think even if you were to bench him, he would still get something above the qualifying offer that would at least count towards the formula. And if he even goes from a fifth to a seventh, but you think you're improving your team, like, so be it.
Yeah, I would agree wholeheartedly on that. So we didn't talk about Emory Jones yet, though. Emory Jones active for the first time for this game, could certainly have been used. What were you hoping when you saw he was active? What were you hoping for?
So I was a bit surprised. I am not of the camp that was hoping, okay, you know, this is the time they're making the change. I didn't expect that to happen. And I don't expect that to happen this week either. If it happens, I could see it happening after the mini bye. So I wasn't thinking that. I was interested, given that it means other guys were deactivated who have typically been active, if they would potentially go to a 6-0 line look in certain situations. You mentioned it before, when they've had trouble getting push, they've done things like bring disconnected tight ends in, or, you know, they've had wide receiver bunches in tight, and none of that has seemed to really work of getting good push. And so maybe that's something you could do a little bit differently, is go very heavy rather than two or three tight ends. Maybe you go a tight end and a sixth offensive lineman and, or, you know, Ricard. But that was something I was thinking was possibly in the cards that we didn't end up seeing.
That is certainly in the bag. The 2008 Ravens, who really depended on the run game and had Joe Flacco at quarterback, They did a lot of sixth offensive line, a lot of unbalanced line, and they had the personnel to do it too. The guy, incredibly, who was on the bench that year for the Ravens was Chris Chester, who went on to have a really fine career in the NFC. He just somehow could not crack the offensive line for the Ravens. Earlier that year, he had the starting role, and guess who won it from him? Marshall Yanda. And it's his own personal tragedy that he played for a Ravens team that had Burke, Yanda, and Grubbs as their interior offensive line. Imagine swapping that group out for today's offensive line and how much better the Ravens would be.
Yeah, an embarrassment of riches.
All right. Let's move on and talk about some skill position players. We always let the guests go first. Who would you like to talk about?
Let's talk about Flowers. I think, you hit on some of the highlights of his day. Probably one of the most productive, not probably, he was the most productive skill position player. Even still, some warts in the game that dropped on the sideline was not great. There was another play where he tried to cut things back. He, was coming back to the ball, moving away from the defender, tried to reverse field back towards the sideline, and it looked like if he had kind of continued straight in his trajectory, he could have broken maybe not to the end zone, but another 10, 15 yards pretty easily. I'm sort of getting into the negative here, but he was the most productive skill position player. So largely liked what I saw out of him, but like the rest of the team, not without blemishes.
Yeah. I'm always in favor of players who want to spend the offseason improving their own position-specific skills with gurus. And Lamar Jackson has been the North Star for the Ravens in those terms. He's always led the way in terms of improving his own game during the season. He brings something new to camp every year. I would love for Flowers to spend some time working with somebody who is a great yak receiver on some tricks, because I'm sure Flowers can pick up most of them. I'm sure most of them are not physicality issues. So there are, an AJ Brown or somebody who is basically a running back in wide receiver clothing. That it's not him that he really needs to learn from. It's somebody who's like a smaller slot receiver or even a Z, whatever it might be, who knows how to make a great U-turn move. To have him learn the tricks of that from somebody who's a wide receiver guru, and I think there would be a good option for improvement for his yak game. Everything he does about getting open right now is as high as I think it needs to be. I don't think he needs to do anything different to like out physical players, because I don't think it'll ever be his game. I don't think
No, absolutely. The only thing I was going to add there was I'm 100% with you that I don't think it's a physical limitation on his part that's preventing him from getting this, this big yak situation. If anything, he's almost too twitchy for his own good. Uh-huh. And that he has the ability to, you saw the play where he went down to the ground and hopped right back up. And potentially that could have put him at risk for a fumble, but he's almost so twitchy and has such great agility that he can almost, most players would not have been able to cut back to the sideline in the way that he did and would have forced themselves to continue into the open grass just because they could not have done what he did. So it is not a physical limitation. Rather, it's a instincts. It's a, how do I know where I need to go with the ball? That I think to your point, he can certainly improve.
Right. I think a lot of it for the great U-turn wide receivers is just being able to kind of visualize the field as you have your back to it. So play action for quarterbacks kind of works the same way. They have to kind of know where things are set up to start, know what they're expecting to see when they turn around. And I think if you kind of have a sense of where everybody is, you may have a really good feel of the cornerback who's close to you, but also know where that safety is, and you make your U-turn move, and hopefully you're not U-turning into his leverage directly, into his path that will it'll make the tackle easy for him. But I think there's more to be gained there, and I'd love to see Zay do it on his own. Let me move on. I want to talk about Keaton Mitchell. It's no secret. I thought he was the Ravens' best player all summer. He's shown some incredible burst at times this year in the preseason and during the regular season as well. Really a shame the 35-yard run got wiped out. He also made a great pass block in this game.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code RAVENS at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
And that really got me. Now, we had them only for a small number of total chips on the game. I'm going to get to my sheet here. I think it was 1-1 in terms of, yeah, so Mitchell only had one set block, no chip blocks. So the one block is the only block I'm thinking of. And the exception to that could have been, he might've had a pass block on another play that ended up being a run. So if you see PFF has him for 2 or 3 blocks in total, that's what the difference would be. He did a great job. He stood up his guy, and I'm thinking, okay, nothing is perfect. Henry hasn't looked good as a blocker. Ali hasn't really looked good as a blocker. Hill is the best the Ravens have, but he's potentially going to be hurt this week because he's DNP on today as we record this on Tuesday, with Wednesday still coming. If that were the case, how about Mitchell as a third down back? I mean, he can catch the football. He has this great transition from catch to run. Of course, did not really look great in that respect with the interception against the Browns. That was his fault. What do you think?
No, that was a big stock down moment in my mind for Mitchell. And with some of the ball on the ground, which I don't think has cost him to this point. I think it's always kind of skirted out of bounds when he's put the ball on the ground or he's down by contact before it pops out. But I do have a few lingering concerns there about, you know, ball security, but he just looks so explosive out there that he only had 2 official carries and I think a reception. You know, 2 gains that were, you know, big gains, like you mentioned, that were negated by penalty. But man, you know, those runs still happened. And in a day where they couldn't get anything going on the ground because of the lack of misdirection and other things, it just seems like they need to find a way to get him more involved if they're going to be that dynamic offense they were earlier in the year. You're on mute, Ken.
Yeah, I'm sorry. One thing I hope they do is insert more Pony into their play sheet. Have some packages for Mitchell used in Pony, both to be a decoy, and it's particularly important with Lamar hobbled, to both be a decoy such that Henry can find some additional space and create opportunity for the blockers and whatnot, and also occasionally get the ball. And I know there's the old comment that Harbaugh mentioned that everybody knows he's getting the ball. No, they don't. They really don't. They know that he's a threat to get the ball, which is perfect. You should use that. And so I hope they find a way to insert that into what they've got. Short week is hard for that. The bye week might be a better opportunity for some of those insertions.
Yeah, absolutely. And in addition to what you just mentioned about being a decoy or getting the ball, even just having him move around the formation and in a way similar to what they do a lot with Zay Flowers. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the Steelers used to do quite a bit with Le'Veon Bell where they'd, you know, take him from the backfield, split him out wide, make the defense show their hand in terms of how they're lining up, you know, get more spacing potentially for other things you want to do, especially if you're running Pony, you know, force, you know, what may be a crowded box, make them thin out a little bit, or, you know, change the play up based on that. But a lot you could do with that.
I think most of the listeners to this show probably know this by now, but I'm going to say it anyway, because there's a few who wouldn't know this. When you see a running back go into motion such that he leaves his position in the backfield, then comes back to it, usually it's often from he leaves from sidecar, he motions out, and then he comes back. What they're trying to do is see who moves to cover that guy. So do they have a man coverage look that they're showing you with a linebacker or whatever? And then some teams are super clever, and they may even be able to disguise that, have someone who's already scheduled to blitz move out to cover that guy, then come back. And that can be extremely clever. But most of the time, the offense gets a small read. It's about as successful as probably when you try and get a read at poker if you're not a very good reader like me, and you try and ask a question that the guy can't possibly answer, and he just knows to go stone-faced at that point. It's something that doesn't often give you information, but it can. There have been certainly times in Ravens history I can remember it giving away man coverage at a critical moment. All right, so I think it's your turn, right?
Yep. So how about Walker? I think he had the great, 30-yard catch, raised his season average, both yards per target, yards per reception. Seems to make every time he gets his number called a big play, but not a ton of snaps, not a ton of opportunities, balls thrown his way. He is seemingly the most popular man in Baltimore, other than maybe Emory Jones at this point. Like what I've seen in the limited opportunities he's had to contribute. One thing I would have liked to see, there's a lot of guys here to try to get the ball to, especially when they're only throwing the ball 24 times. But I think he would have been a good option, especially on a day you're missing Bateman rather. Mm-hmm. When the Jets are crowding, putting eight men in the box, trying to make them pay for that by, taking a quick drop back and airing it out if you have single coverage on the outside and either loosening it up or trying to make them pay for that. I think Walker would have been a good option for that.
Yeah. So there's two possibilities. You can beat a single high look outside the numbers with that, and you could beat a cover zero look, which you can always beat by trying to throw over it. And the cover zero look, they faced a lot against Minnesota. They were just, a lot of guys at the line of scrimmage crowding, showing blitz. They would often drop out of that, but that's not someone who's going to be covering Tez Walker on that play. You're effectively committing to leaving that cornerback alone on Tez Walker. And the other guy who's very dangerous, even though he's not speedy anymore, is DeAndre Hopkins, who can, force that cornerback into very bad position at the point of the catch, where he may create a foul. He may be able to get separation with a veteran move, as they call it. You can see me kind of using air quotes here, or he can go up and get the football and high point it effectively. All those are possible. And Tez Walker, beating him with just speed is good. The other thing I liked about Walker in this game is coming back for the football and scooping it out. That's really nice. And Walker, that's not something that he was necessarily great at college. It's something he worked on very hard, I think, this offseason and through camp, was to get better at coming back for the football. And you even saw the one game he had, which was, I think, Dallas was his big game in the preseason. It was about six targets he had, and a bunch of maybe almost all of them were non-verticals, where he either had to run some sort of out route and make a play on the ball, or curl back and make a play on a on schedule throw or a throw at least coming back for the ball. It's very good. It's exactly what he needs to do. And if you want to pick another player that could benefit a lot from more off-season wide receiver training, those two routes, being able to do any kind of a comeback route to go with a vertical route, is that's the combination you need to have in the NFL. Derek Mason made his whole career pretty much on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So that was you, right?
Yep.
Let's move on. Well, I want to talk about Patrick Ricard. Great game. This game is one of the real, I think, one of the Ravens stars in the game, that he certainly had one of his better blocking games of the season. We're worried about his health. We get new data points every week with Patrick Ricard. In his case, it's the real question is, can he play one more year? Right now, I'm right on the fence. I mean, I wasn't as good as on the fence 2 or 3 weeks ago. I thought that this would be, a more sensible time just to move on from Ricard. The dollars are not significant, by the way. Ricard makes a few dollars over the vet minimum, but those dollars are all veteran salary benefit, and so they don't count against the cap. So they could give that money to somebody else, which would be a starting point. So they lose it in that sense. But also, it's quite possible Ricard will still be a serviceable fullback next year.
Yeah, I think fully agreed. There was a couple points when he first came back that we weren't seeing the same Patrick Ricard. I think in this game, the running game looked, in a day they were having trouble getting anything going, looked significantly better when he was on the field. I think down the stretch he's going to be an important part of this, particularly if you don't have the dynamism from Lamar at the mesh point, misdirection, et cetera. But very excited and happy with what I saw from Ricard in this game. So I think I am next. Maybe we could talk about Hopkins briefly. Sure. I think he continues to have one or two catches a game, just in big moments, makes secure grab. Again, did it in this game with a big play to help sustain a drive. Lamar clearly feels comfortable going to him. I don't know that I want to see more of him only because I like the balance that if we're running 60% of the time versus 40% pass, even if the results aren't there, but glad to see him get involved. The miss going down the left sideline, he put a really nice move on the cornerback to get him kind of caught in his own feet. It was wide open there. If Lamar had maybe just put that ball a slight bit better, I think, you know, that's one he wants to have back and would have liked to just have another go against, but it was just oh so slightly missed. So again, loving what I'm seeing out of Hopkins. He's doing exactly what we brought him here to do. Yeah, not much more else to say.
Yeah, and I'll go with the play balance for you. I mean, this was a game, there's an old saying that teams don't win because they run because they win. And this was definitely a game where the Ravens ran because they won. They had the lead, they leaned on the Jets in the second half, not really with a tremendous success in the run game, but they had enough that they were able to stay on the field in the third and fourth quarters and grind out some yards and grind out the win and hold serve on the win in a lot of ways once they got that lead. So yeah, I'm thrilled with that kind of thing. And everybody who's a fantasy football player absolutely hates the Baltimore Ravens for exactly this reason. And if you're a Lamar fan, you bemoan the fact that's not true. If you're a good Lamar fan, you appreciate Lamar the winner and you don't care about Lamar the 4,000 yard passer. But there's a whole bunch of people who care about Lamar the 4,000 yard passer, and they say the offense is being run wrong if Lamar isn't getting 4,000 yards with this set of receivers. Well, no, they're winning, they're playing winning football, and that's what happens. Is you it's very difficult to get 4,000 yards passing when you're playing winning football and you have the kind of weapons the Ravens do to run the football. And you have Lamar as the centerpiece of your entire offense running at a fair degree to take touches away from other players.
Yeah, I mean, the one caveat I would say, the first half, there's definitely some more things they could have done to extend drives there. I, at a macro level, when you zoom out and look at the game results, fully aligned, I do think there's maybe some opportunities to be a little bit more dynamic on offense when we see what we did in the first half. But overall, yeah, 100% aligned.
All right. We got some questions in the mailbag. I also want to remind you to have a 3-2-1 for MVPs because we'll get that to in a little bit. Let's go through some of these questions, though. Bufudu from Reddit is also wants to be known as Andrew, so I'll start calling you that. What can they do to help the running game if Lamar isn't a threat? Without him as a threat, they're just a normal offense with an average run blocking line. But I watched the 49ers gash Carolina last night, and Purdy isn't an option threat either. They do have a couple of things they can do, and we've talked about some of them, but your only misdirection option isn't Lamar. It's the best misdirection option. It's the most valuable misdirection option, no doubt about it. But they also could use pony backfield, counters. As you mentioned, you want to talk about the pistol again?
Yeah, going into pistol opens up a couple different things. Like you mentioned, allows the tailback to get a more downhill run versus when they're in sidecar, then gives Lamar the option to sprint out, be the outside threat, whereas when you have the sidecar look, he's much more of the inside threat. But that's something they could do, especially if they have trepidation about Lamar running up into the guts of the defense. Sprinting out where he maybe takes less pounding hits is something they could do. And we saw that a little bit more in this game, you know, not to huge success necessarily, but more than we've seen it the last couple weeks or even years with Monken.
Second question from Andrew. He says, also, should they maybe run a little more of the Tyler Huntley offense with Lamar if Lamar is being so limited? And what he's really getting at is do they need to scheme the ball out of Lamar's hands more quickly, meaning have more on-time throws they demand of Lamar? I think that's possible, but it really goes against the grain of who Lamar is. And you know, the guy who's been the biggest quote-unquote loser in this situation has been Rashad Bateman. Even though he set the all-time Ravens record for a wide receiver in yards per target last year, he's the guy who is the Ravens' best route runner and is losing most of the quick throws that Lamar could make on slants and comebacks and whatnot to make plays. It's just not what Lamar really wants to do as a quarterback, and it's not really where a lot of Lamar's value is. If you asked him to do that a high percentage of the time, you'd lose some of his value in terms of extending plays and throwing it out. Now, that said, I think you're onto something in terms of this year, who Lamar is and what the value of those extended plays are. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, Spencer.
Yeah, I just really have trouble with anything that starts with, like, let's take away the most dangerous aspect of Lamar's game. I know some of it is limited by injury this year, but if the Ravens are going to make a deep run in the playoffs, they have to have some semblance, in my opinion, of what Lamar can do. And it's not that he can't be successful with quick throws. We've seen in that Colts game where he put up, you know, a video game like stat line several years ago, where he ended up something like 39 of 44 and 400, whatever it was. You know, he can come out and just run a quick offense. He can do it. But if, you know, with that was a little bit backed up by the threat of Lamar running as well. And if we're going to make a deep run, as much as I want to keep Lamar healthy and protect him from himself, there's got to be some of that, I think.
Yeah. Well, I agree. And I think in both cases, they have their best player on each side of the ball has an injury concern that they have to ask him to do some things to make the playoffs and certainly to make a deep run in the playoffs that are going to, they're going to entail some additional injury risk. It's really unfortunate, but Kyle Hamilton playing close to the line of scrimmage is kind of non-negotiable for this defense. Lamar Jackson running the football is kind of non-negotiable for this offense. We did have another related question from Angelov85, who says, based on your study of film, is this version of Lamar better than a fully healthy Huntley? Okay, I can say for sure yes. Okay, for starters, Huntley is very limited, has a lot of pocket awareness issues. You really have to scheme the ball out of quickly, whereas Lamar can decide whether he wants to get rid of the football or not and usually makes extremely good judgments in that regard. But given LJ's lack of mobility, would it have been better to sit Lamar for some games and bring him back for the divisional games?
I think this completely forgets, you know, as much as I like Tyler Huntley as a backup in Baltimore, there was that stretch where he went something like 1-5 or 1-6 as the starter. Mm-hmm. I think you're assuming a lot to say, do we start Huntley for a few games and then bring back Lamar for the divisional games? I think you cannot count on, you can't really count on Huntley getting you any wins in that situation. And I think the division lead they have now is so precarious that I just can't get there on this one.
I mean, I don't think they'd be anywhere near where they are right now if Tyler Huntley had played all the games since Chicago, for example. I mean, I think it would be, you know, might you be in a better injury situation with Lamar? Yeah, possibly. Might they have two more losses and be in a position that looks more like the Bengals right now than where the Steelers are and still have an enormous uphill climb to, you know, have thoughts of winning? I think that's probably where they would be.
I would just add that I think we talked about this a little bit in the first half. The schedule is set up such that there are some built-in opportunities for Lamar to get a little bit of rest as we go through here. So perhaps you run or you take the governor off a little bit for this Cincinnati game. Then you have the mini bye that follows after that. If they can seize and capitalize, you know, win against Pittsburgh and then, you know, do what they need to do in some of the games that follow that, and Pittsburgh, you know, drops a few more, they have a tough schedule. You also set yourselves up for potentially resting starters that last week. So you can almost maybe, rather than ratcheting it down and playing conservatively and having to play, what do we have left, 6 more games in full, is there a world where you can actually, you know, play a little bit more aggressively but actually win yourself an effective bye there for Lamar at the end of the season?
Right. What's the origin of the term governor? Is that a horse racing team or a horse?
In an engine. So if you have like a go-kart or a car that you don't want to run at top speed, you have a governor on the engine that doesn't allow it to get above a certain point.
I didn't know that. Okay, I figured it out from context what you meant, but I couldn't. I didn't know where it's from. All right, outstanding. We got another one from Baltimore Sports Jam, who says it seems obvious that Lamar is not himself physically and possibly mentally. I wouldn't want to go there. Would it be better to have a more managed game plan like they have with Tyler Huntley and ask Lamar to be Superman only once or twice a game? Pretty much the same question. I'm just going to say I think echo what Spencer did earlier, which is, any controls you put on Lamar to be not Lamar are probably going to be hurtful controls. Lamar still has very good judgment about when to get rid of the football. And I think even the sacks he's taken, usually he's taking a 2-yard sack or he's taking a 4-yard sack, this sort of thing where he's kind of thinking or still deciding, is he going to run the ball or not? His internal judgments about that have always been very good. And that's why his forced not to pass numbers, which combine his scrambles and his sacks, always look very good.
Yeah, and I think having that credible threat of Lamar doing the things that Lamar can do just benefits you in so many ways. And if you're doing anything that, you know, signals or telegraphs that you're limiting him and you're only going to do these things until you really need to, I think that just puts you in such a disadvantaged position versus a bit more of an open playbook situation where anything can happen at any time as a defense. And it just, we've seen this before. It just freezes people. So I am really, again, as much as I want Lamar to remain healthy and protect him from himself, even I just have trouble with anything that, you know, hinders what makes him so special.
Yeah. With you all the way. Well, let's move on. Talk about the MVPs in this game and start with you, and we'll do a little 3-2-1 countdown. Who's your number three MVP on the offense?
I debated this one quite a bit, and there's not a ton of great candidates on this one. I think on the defensive side of the show, probably had a lot more to pick from, but I ended up going with Ricard in my third spot.
Good
I
spot.
Think when he was in there, that made the run much more, the run game was much more effective when he was in there. I liked what he was able to do. I think down the stretch, especially if Lamar's not 100%, he's going to be a critical piece, but really liked what I saw from Ricard in this game.
Yeah, completely agree with that. Good choice. And he probably would have been my number three if I didn't cheat and take Jordan Stout as my number three guy. We've got to talk about him at some point. I mean, he at one of the greatest punting games ever by a Raven, including the tie for the longest punt ever, and another one that was over 60 yards. I think he's 67 and a 74. I think he had two punts. They're up there. His average for the game was over 60. And the last punt, which pinned it back at the 5-yard line with 3:11, took all the rest of the air out of that pillow. I mean, that was just nothing left after that. And a celebration and a well-deserved one. It was a Ray Guy-esque effort.
Yeah, he definitely helped contribute to the field position game tremendously, especially when the team didn't have much going. I think we're starting to see, thinking back, he was one of those, I believe it was 6 fourth-round picks. And there was a lot of questions and head scratching, particularly when they didn't take, I'm probably mispronouncing his name, Matt Ariza, if they were going to take a punter at all. Yeah. And he's really starting to capitalize or show that, you know, they did know what they were doing on that pick, playing like one of the best punters in the league this year. And also as a holder for Loop, he's been great this year. So not much more to ask for.
I mean, you know, for the people who claim that they didn't get anything for their fourth round picks, one thing you need to do is very simply is just rank the order of something like AV of the players that they drafted in that round relative to the others. And you'll find that Ravens have done uniformly outstanding, and your expectation of the pick is too high if you're thinking about, you know, what might you get. But they got Daniel Faalele, and not only did they get some play out of Daniel Faalele, they're going to get a compensatory pick or a formula adjustment for him as well. But he's been at least a placeholder, regardless of whether you think he's really been a good player or not. He was for a portion of last year. He has not been utterly terrible this year. You can do much worse, believe me, than he's been. But you've got that. And then you go to the rest of that fourth round, and the Ravens didn't do particularly poorly at all in 22. They got Jalen Armour-Davis, who they kept for a few years. They cut him going into year four. Unfortunate, you know, might have been a guy who could have helped the Ravens more. They got Charlie Kolar, who's, you know, headed for free agency and is probably going to be one of the players who gets the Ravens a comp pick very directly. I think he's going to get paid, by the way. It'll be a Josh Oliver-like contract. Seem reasonable, by the way?
Yeah, no, I think that's spot on. I think maybe people will be less surprised than they will Faalele, but I think the number that he gets, people who maybe don't pay as close of attention to these things and you know, religiously listen to your show are going to be a bit surprised by the numbers.
Right. Then they got Jordan Stout at number 130. And he'll be re-signed. I'm fairly sure they'll extend him. They'll keep the Wolfpack together. They really love him as a holder, and he's coming into his own as a punter this year, which is nice. You got Isaiah Likely, who the question is, do they franchise him? Do they try and sign him to some other deal? Is the contract that they offered him before too much, such that they can't keep that as an open option, and they have to reduce it, which might make it more likely that he's going to want to, you know, hit the road? Honestly, every single game that passes is a risk of players like Likely, Jones, and Linderbaum leaving the team. But Likely is a player who, you know, fourth round pick, certainly got value. And then the only other fourth round pick they had that didn't work out all the way was Damarian Williams, who Pepe was on the team for two full seasons before he got cut. I think it's two, got cut last year. I have a hard time pointing to those six fourth round picks and say the Ravens didn't get value out of those selections.
Yeah, I think that's 4 out of 6 fourth round picks being, even if you want to quibble with whether they're hits or not, I would say they all are. But even if someone wants to quibble with that, having, you know, 2/3 of your fourth round picks being there to close out their rookie contract by any reasonable metric is success.
Yes. And that's a great point. All right. So Jordan Stout, my number three guy, we go to your number two guy.
Zay Flowers. Again, I mentioned before, by far the most productive skill position player, made a lot of great plays, loved what he did to, I think it was the exact right balance, selling that PI right at the goal line, even though they put the ball at the 5. He was indeed hooked. He put a little bit of acting to make sure it was clear that that he was hooked, but he was hooked nonetheless. He had his man beat. So definitely did well there. One blemish was the drop down the sideline. A little bit like we talked about, he could do better with kind of field awareness and generating yak. But, you know, he was one of the sole bright spots on the offense today. So that's why I put him at number two.
Yeah. And the only thing I'd say is about what you said earlier, which I didn't really respond to at the time, was he's sometimes too twitchy for his own good. I'm not saying that doesn't show up, but it's that twitchiness which makes him absolutely uncoverable at the top of the stem. That cornerback has no ability to react to his foot plant, to him planting his foot in the ground and moving to the inside, which has been the major weapon the Ravens have used this year, is going to Flowers between level 2 and level 3. So he's my number two guy also. Who's your number one guy?
Just really quickly, one last thing about Zay Flowers and that twitchiness. I just do want to be clear. When I say too twitchy for his own good, it's because other people would not be physically able to make the decision that he's making to cut back against the field. And it's impressive nonetheless, and fully agree that it benefits him overall, but just that he's able to make a decision where, you know, other people would not be able to. but anyway, my number one, almost by default in this game, I went with Lamar, that he protected the ball, you know, didn't put the ball ever in jeopardy. He was limited, but there's a little bit of a dearth of options for MVPs in this one. So again, it's Lamar in my number one spot, but more so by default than him having a particularly great game.
All right, well, that's fair enough. And I thought about Lamar for 2, for 3 and where he would be. Eventually, I ended up the way I did. Jordan Stout over Lamar, by the way. I don't really believe Jordan Stout was more valuable than Lamar, but Jordan Stout would rarely get a chance to be on this list, so he deserves a chance once in a while to be talked about. Yeah. Ronnie Stanley is my number one guy. I had his best game of the year for certain. One of the things I like in the MVP list is to try and pick out who gave you the most hope for the rest of the season. And I think it's Ronnie of the players we had. You know, nothing wrong with Jordan Stout's game, nothing wrong with what Zay did, but nothing wrong with Patrick Ricard did either. That's a big portent game. But Ronnie Stanley, he had been hurting and not looking great at left tackle, and he turned in a top drawer game at a time where we're looking forward to stretch of games that is again difficult.
Yeah, no, absolutely can't fault that pick at all. And I think you're convincing me a little bit, because obviously you scored the line much more closely and had a clear view there. I think my only hesitation was that when you look at the results, and it's hard to pin that on one person, that's always the difficulty of doing linemen for the MVP section of the show.
Yeah.
But I think the way you're positioning it makes a lot of sense, and particularly that what it portends for the rest of the year, I can definitely buy that.
All right. Always great talking football with you, Spencer. So happy you could spend a couple hours doing this. Tell folks where they can talk football with you online.
Yeah, you can find me at Twitter/X at Spencer CP. That's spelled SpencerCP. Always happy to talk Ravens there.
All right. Make sure you tag him into a conversation. You see the quality of conversation you get from someone like Spencer. And this is why I like having him on the show so much. Whatever the topic may be, he's been a fill-in on Friday Morning GM at times, along with Matt Ruff. And they both done a great job when Voss was putting his restaurant together and they couldn't spend time doing it every week. He's been on a number of shorts. You've done the expectation series, right? You had 2 players for that.
Yeah. I think both of mine have done quite well this year. I think I had Tavius Robinson and Teddy Buchanan this year. So both on the positive side, Robinson a little bit limited by his injury, yeah. But both kind of showing up on the positive end of their expectations.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's pretty positive in terms of the where the arrows are pointing on those guys in particular. All right. Other folks out there, appreciate you tremendously for listening. If you want to do one nice thing for the show, use hashtag Film Study Mailbag for a question for the show. We always appreciate that. Write us a 5-star, 50-word review if you don't mind taking a few minutes to do that, or tell that one person who doesn't know about the show, and hopefully we'll grow a little bit by word of mouth. Spencer, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.